The Triathlon Show 343. Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host, Michael, and on today's episode, I interview Dr. Danielle Muniz, who has done some fascinating work utilizing big data from Strava, from a marathon runner specifically, where him and his co-author set out to explore how decoupling, meaning in this case specifically the ratio of heart rate to pace, can be an important parameter in marathon and possibly broader endurance performance. So we'll explore that, the findings that Dr. Muniz and his co-authors found, and how that can be used in practice as well. But before that, big thanks to our sponsors, Roka. Roka produce exceptional quality triathlon wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, performance sunglasses, and prescription eyeglasses and sunglasses. Today, I want to talk a bit more about Roka's range of eyewear. All of Roka's eyeglasses and sunglasses come with Geeko anti-slip technology, so they never fall off your face. They are also extremely lightweight and have fantastic optics. The performance sunglasses are developed for and tested in the most challenging conditions in the world. They are used in sports from triathlon through speed skating through outdoor and adventure activities. And for their range of prescription glasses, there is a home tryout program, and you can renew your prescription with a simple online vision test at home in front of your computer. All products have multiple options for frames and lenses, and they all come with a 2-year warranty. The glasses that I use personally are the Rory prescription glasses and the Phantom Aviator sunglasses, as well as the Matador and Matador Air performance sunglasses for sports. Visit roka.com/TTS to get 20% off your entire order. And thank you to Zenate. The Zenate Indoor Swim Trainer is a swim training tool that you can use at home, allowing you to improve your technique, work on power and stamina, and save time and stay consistent. It is a fantastic way to work on swim-specific core activation, as the instability element of the bench forces you to stabilize your core, and it helps you work on a high elbow catch because the height of the swim bench is perfectly designed for forcing you to keep that elbow up. You can get tips and specific workouts on how to use the trainer on the Zenate social media channels like YouTube and Instagram. And the Zenate Swim Trainer is very affordable, even more so with a 20% discount code that you can get on zenateswimtrainer.com/TTS. Now, without any further ado, let's get into the interview with Dr. Danielle Muniz. Welcome to the Triathlon Show, Danielle. How are you doing?
I'm very good, thank you.
Can you start by just giving an introduction of yourself to the listeners and the audience that might not know who you are?
Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Danielle Muniz, and I'm Spanish, but living in the UK. I did my PhD at St. Mary's University in Twickenham, which is West London. And now I work as a lecturer in physiology at the University of Hertfordshire, which is, again, close to London, just North London.
Yeah, perfect. And what can you explain a bit more about what type of things you have been studying in your PhD and in your postdoc studies?
Yeah, absolutely. So my PhD was on anaerobic capacity, which is probably far away from what most of your listeners will be. So we were trying to quantify anaerobic energy production. But during my PhD, I became interested in critical power and critical speed, and as well W prime and D prime, which is the anaerobic, if you wish, kind of component of the power duration relationship. And since finishing my PhD, I am trying to, I guess, apply the critical power W prime and critical speed D prime model to different situations, so prescribing exercise, kind of quantifying performance and a number of things. So trying to apply the model a little bit more.
Yeah, that's great. And many listeners will be very familiar with critical power and W prime because we've had guests like Mark Burnley on and many others talking about critical power before. So yeah, that's not a new concept by any means. The reason that I invited you on is a study that you recently published that was about decoupling of internal and external workload during marathon running. So that is an open access paper. I'll link to it in the show notes so listeners can go and read through it. But can you introduce this paper? What did you want to investigate more specifically, and what was the background that led you to do this research?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess if we start with the background, the first author I met, actually, Barry Smith, which is the first author of the paper, that was probably 3 years ago at a conference. And Barry is a data analyst, and he's obviously very, very good with numbers and dealing with big data sets. But he also has an interest in marathon running. So when we met, he had this massive data set from Strava runners, or Strava athletes, I guess. And I wanted to look at whether we can apply the critical speed concept to predict marathon performance in just using raw training data. So just from your normal training data, whether we can get an estimation of critical speed, and then whether that estimation can be used to predict performance. And we did that. We published that a couple of years ago. But one of the key findings that we saw in that paper was that the best athletes in this data set were able to complete the marathon at a speed that were closer to the critical speed, so at a higher percentage of the critical speed. And the, I guess, less fit individuals, so runners that complete the marathon in perhaps, you know, 3 hours, 3.5 hours, 4 hours, they tend to do so at a lower percentage of their critical speed as well. So it's not just that your critical speed can determine performance, but also the percentage at which you of your critical speed that you run the marathon. So with that in mind,
just one follow-up question on that. Can you talk about what is the percentage that you found? For example, what is the difference in what is the percentage that a 2.5 hour marathoner can run their marathon on average versus 4 hour marathon?
Yeah. So my thought when we did that paper was that everyone was going to be at a close to maybe 90-95% of their critical speed. There is some paper from Andy Jones and Annie Van Hatalo that in elite top world-class athletes, marathon runners, they run the marathon at 96-97% of their critical speed. Those are guys that are running the marathon in just over 2 hours. For us, what we saw is that the average value was 85%, but we saw that people, runners that can run the marathon in, say, 2.5 hours, they do so at around 90% of their critical speed. And then that goes down in a fairly linear fashion to about 75-78% of their critical speed for runners that complete the marathon in about 4 hours or so.
And it makes sense, right? Because if you're out there for 4 hours, then that's twice the duration of somebody that's out there for 2 hours. So naturally, you will have to be at a lower percentage of your critical speed when you think of it as a duration rather than as a distance.
Yeah. So we with that in mind, I guess, with that background, then Ed Maunder published his decoupling paper with Steven Saylor and others. And we kind of discussed that with some PhD students. And we kind of link all the dots together. So we've got Barry with big data sets and the computer skills to analyze the data. We've done this paper on critical speed where we saw that decline in the percentage of critical speed that runs complete the marathon. And then Ed is publishing this decoupling paper. And basically, we got in touch with everyone. And I guess that's where we end up doing this this paper.
So what was the research question that you tried to examine here?
So the broad research question was, is this phenomenon that Ed is describing really happening in marathon runners? And do we need to take this into consideration? Is this going to make a difference for the average marathon runner? And I guess what we found, one of the key messages was that this is indeed happening. So we saw that, better marathon runners show a low decoupling in the internal to external workload. And I guess less or slower runners, less fit individuals tend to exhibit a greater magnitude, a greater size of this decoupling in an internal to external workload.
Let's define decoupling first, by the way, for listeners that are not familiar.
Yeah, so decoupling is, it's sort of the easy definition, to put it simply, is you calculate your internal workload, so how much physiological stress you are under, and the external workload, which could be something like your speed if you're running or your power output if you're cycling. And you calculate that ratio early in the race or early in the training session, and then you see how that ratio kind of whether it increases, meaning that for the same speed, you are under an increased level of physiological stress. And we looked at the size of that decoupling and also where that decoupling starts, at what point that decoupling starts.
So when you're looking at internal workload, in theory, it could be oxygen uptake or lactate, but in this case, it was heart rate that you looked at.
Yeah. So I think it probably would be better if you have access to measures of, you know, as you say, VO2, oxygen uptake, or lactate. But in this particular, because we are using Strava, we were using Strava data from Strava, we only had access to heart rate, and we had to go with that. So I think heart rate is a kind of accessible, easy enough to use metric that most of your audience can implement.
Yeah. So if we go in a bit more detail about the methods, how did you calculate decoupling in this case? You took two different points in the marathon where you had for the reference numbers.
Yeah. The data that we have, we split into, so it's obviously a full marathon, and we also have the 6 months of training before the marathon. Four to six months, I can't remember now. And what we did first, we looked at, we estimated their critical speed by using their best performance over a set of distances in their training. And then we looked at the marathon data. We calculated the critical speed, and we were looking at that ratio between the internal and external workload. Over 5K intervals. So start of the race, 0 to 5K, then 5 to 10K, then to 15, and so on. We kind of ignored the first 5K because we kind of assumed that people were not running at a constant pace and just, you know, beginning of the race, maybe some level of stress there, trying to get on a good spot. So we normalized relative to the 5 to 10K segment of the marathon. And then we looked at that ratio between the internal and external workload at 5K segments. So the 10 to 15, 15 to 20, and so on.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and you took the 35 to 40 kilometer segment as
calculated. To calculate the size of that decoupling, we looked at the last 5K segment, so the 35 to 40K.
Yeah, and in addition to the size, you also looked at the onset of decoupling and how did you
we wanted to look at when this is starting to, you know, when do we first see this decoupling, and we had to define a starting point, so we opted for a 2.5% in this decoupling, which is a completely arbitrary value, but we had to go with something. And we've opted for this 2.5%, and we looked at basically when that decoupling exceeds that 2.5% and stays above that 2.5% for the remaining of the race.
Yeah, yeah. So that would be, let's say you're starting your marathon at 150 beats per minute. When you get to roughly 155 beats per minute, if I do my math right, that would be
assuming you're running at a constant
at the same speed. Exactly. Okay. So just to summarize for the listeners, so you basically looked at these two things: the magnitude of the decoupling, which was the comparison of the 35 to 40 kilometer segment with the 5 to 10 kilometer segment. And again, if you're running at a constant speed throughout, then you could, and let's say you were running at 150 beats per minute in the first segment of those segments, and then 165 to make the math easy in the 35 to 40 kilometer, then you would have a 10% decoupling because of a 15 beats per minute increase from 150 to give an example. And that onset, again, we just talked about, but when the internal workload rose by 2.5% for a fixed external workload. And of course it works. You can do the math even if the pace changes. So that's obviously what you did. And you had 82,000. Yeah, sorry, go on.
No, just a quick point, because I think one of the things that we saw is that, I mean, you might expect heart rate to drift up a little bit, but what we saw is that the heart rate actually remained fairly constant, and what was a bit of a decline was the speed, the pacing of the marathon. So basically, you are running at the same heart rate, you're 150 or 160, whatever, but actually you are slowing down a little bit.
Yeah. And you had, important to point out, is that you had 82,000 plus runners in this data set.
Yeah. So that's I guess the strength of the study. So that's different. That's kind of new to me. I'm an exercise physiologist, so we usually deal with much way smaller sample sizes of 15, 20 athletes that we managed to get in the lab. And here we have access to a massive data set from Strava. And I guess we have to make some compromises. So, we're talking about the heart rate before, which perhaps is not the best, but it's handy. It's a handy metric. But yeah, we have a massive data set of runners.
Yeah. So then you looked at, okay, how did the decoupling, both the onset and the magnitude, relate to marathon performance? Can you explain that bit, how you did that and what did you find?
Yeah, so going back to that paper that we published a couple of years ago, so remember we saw that faster runners can run at a higher percentage of their critical speed. And what we show here is that those faster runners, I think, or kind of our sort of hypothesis would be that they can run at a higher percentage of their critical speed because they are able to maintain that critical speed throughout the marathon. So what we think, or I guess I think might be happening, is that when you start your marathon, your critical speed is here at this value, at this intensity, for example, at this pace. But as you progress into the race, that critical speed is going to deteriorate. It's going to start to go down slowly. And if you are able to minimize the degree of that decrease in critical speed, you are able to run at a higher percentage of that critical speed for the whole of the marathon. So what we saw in this paper was that those athletes that exhibit a low amplitude in this decoupling were able to run the marathon faster than athletes that exhibit a greater percentage. But not only that, they can also run the marathon at a higher percentage of their critical speed.
Yeah, that makes sense. Didn't Andy Jones publish some data where they looked at exactly how much critical power decreases after you've done some kind of long and moderately hard exercise?
Yeah. So there's a couple of two or three papers from Andy Jones's lab in Exeter looking at precisely this. So they actually got people to, or they calculated their critical power before and after a couple of hours of cycling at a fairly decent pace. And they saw it's something around that 10% decrease in critical power over the 2 hour period, which kind of matches what we are seeing here with this, being able to perform the marathon at around 90% if you are fairly fit of your critical speed.
Yeah, that's a good. Well, it aligns well. It aligns well with those previous findings. So you said that the amplitude was well correlated with the percentage of critical speed that the runners could maintain. What about the onset? Did that have any relation to other key variables you looked at?
Yeah, I think the onset was also able to predict performance, and probably based on what the data that we have, the two probably go together. So if you, there seems to be a fairly linear rate of decoupling. So the speed at which you are decoupling, if that makes sense, is probably fairly linear. So if you start early, you're going to end up having a larger magnitude in this decoupling. And if you are able to delay that onset of decoupling, the final magnitude is going to be smaller.
Yeah.
So I do believe, though, that the magnitude, the total size of this decoupling is, as I see it anyway, more important than the onset. Because there might be athletes, and that's perhaps something that we need to look further, but there might be athletes that do start to exhibit some degree of decoupling, but then that rate of decoupling is not so fast. So you start to decouple early or earlier, but you don't see a massive final magnitude in the decoupling.
So if I understand that correctly, basically they could be related or the same. Basically, we don't quite know if they're independent or not.
We don't know. I certainly don't know. I think they're going to be related. But I think that the main, if we have to kind of pick one, obviously, I think we try to look at the two of them. But to me, the magnitude will be the main driver in kind of ability to maintain a high percentage of your critical speed or your critical power.
And by that, obviously, we mean that the less the decoupling you have, then the better your ability to maintain a high percentage of critical speed.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah.
Okay. So, what do you think this means first of all, if we start with just general key points, and this doesn't have to be, this could be for the scientific and academic community as much as for practitioners and athletes, but yeah, what are the key points to take away from this study?
I think the key point, and there seems to be a kind of growing body of papers and data showing that don't assume that your physiology at the beginning of the race is going to be the same as the physiology, say 2, 3, 4 hours into, in this case, the marathon. There is going to be some deterioration in your physiology, in your VO2 max, in your thresholds, and your critical speed or critical power. And I think the key message is that we need to look at this. We need to, you know, same as you do your VO2 max and same as you do your lactate threshold, and you kind of calculate those values. We need to think about how that physiology is going to be affected by a couple of hours, 3 hours of heavy intensity exercise.
Yeah, and I did an interview with Ed Maunder and Steven Seiler that you mentioned about fatigue resistance or durability, and we talked about that. I'll link to it in the show notes for listeners that haven't listened to it. But I think this is a really interesting case of a potential measure of that fatigue resistance durability that we specifically talked about. That this is an interesting concept, but we don't really know yet how to measure it, and maybe this decoupling can be one way of at least getting some insight that we can quantify about your durability.
I think the decoupling is perhaps not the best way of measuring fatigue or fatigability, but it's definitely something that most athletes can use on a, you know, daily basis or regular basis. It's something that is, I think, easy enough to do, and it can have very clear practical implications.
Yeah, and well, that's going to be my next question then. What do you think are the practical applications of using decoupling in general and your studies, your findings in this study in particular?
So I think the as I said, to me, how I see this is we need to check this. We need to be aware of how your ability is going to kind of perform in a prolonged exercise. So I guess the main thing I will suggest or I would recommend athletes is to check if they can the decoupling during a kind of one of the long run, if you know what I mean, the prolonged exercise training that they might be doing. I will recommend that they check that. And as well, during the marathon, if you are racing and you start to see that there is some decoupling, that's something that perhaps we can kind of pay attention during the actual race. I would love, and I think that, you know, I think you mentioned about Mark Bonley, he was talking about kind of incorporating critical speed and D-prime and all of that to the technology, all this technology that we are having nowadays with your GPS and all your sensors. So I do think that in a few years' time, there are going to be, you know, your Garmin watch or whatever is going to incorporate some metrics that kind of link your physiological stress, your heart rate, for example, and your kind of external workload, your speed or your power if you're cycling.
So I think
we are at the beginning of implementing all of this, but I think there is going to be quite a bit of work on implementing all of this into I guess, tools that can help athletes.
Yeah. How would you use it as an athlete if you're training for a marathon and you go out for your long run, as you say? Would you mostly analyze it kind of week by week that, okay, since 1 month ago, I'm now, my decoupling is a lot lower magnitude, or would you use it even within the workout? What do you need to be quite controlled in the way that you use it in similar conditions, similar workouts? Can you give some tips for going a bit deeper into the practical applications?
That's a good question. I guess I will try to control or try to measure decoupling in the certainly in the weeks leading to the marathon, and particularly in those sessions that are going to be more specific and that are going to be most similar to the actual event. So if you go for a 25-30k run, I will try to keep an eye on the internal workload in your heart rate and your external workload, your speed, and see how that ratio between the two changes from, say, the first 10 minutes to the, half an hour and a half into the run. I guess something that we don't quite know is if you detect that there is a decoupling and you want to address that and you want to minimize that, at the moment, we don't have very good data on what we can do to minimize that. So we know this is happening, but we don't necessarily know why this is happening or what can you do to address this issue. If you see that this, you go for a run and you see that there is, I'm experiencing decoupling, what can I do about it? At the moment, we don't quite know what type of training you can do to reduce that, to address that issue. So, I mean, we can hypothesize, we can argue that, I guess, in my view, going for long exercise sessions, your long runs is probably going to help. But as far as I know, we don't have, good solid data on what exactly you can do to try to minimize that decoupling.
Yeah. Coming back to the practical use and the long run, using it in long run, just one thing that I'm thinking of is that maybe you could use it as a bit of a safety check almost when you're doing your marathon specific workout. Let's say you're doing 5 kilometers of marathon pace within a long run in kilometer 5 to 10 of your long run, and then you're doing another 5 kilometer in kilometer 25 to 30 in your long run, and maybe you're having one in the middle as well. But comparing those two 5 kilometers, if you check your decoupling and you find that, it's 1.40 or something, then based on the, let's call it normative reference values that you have from this study, the runner in this case can maybe know that, okay, maybe this pace is not sustainable for me for a marathon if I have this magnitude of decoupling.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think if you, as you say, if you are exercising at what you think is going to be your marathon pace and you start to see a decoupling of 1.1, 1.2, so that's a 10% or 20% decoupling in internal to external workload, that's going to be a red flag, and it's like, oh, I need to revisit my pacing strategy for the marathon, because that might not be sustainable and I might suffer later on in the race.
Yeah, and then coming back to what you were just discussing about how to work on it and potentially improve it, do we know anything about I'm not asking now about how to improve it, but just the mechanisms behind decoupling?
Not exactly about decoupling. We can sort of speculate with things that are likely to have an effect. I think decoupling is going to be affected by it's obviously a complex trait, so it's going to be quite a few things that determine your decoupling. But I don't think there is, again, kind of solid data on exactly what determines the size, the magnitude of the decoupling that you might or might not experience. I guess we can look at things like your, percentage of muscle fibers, the type 1 muscle fibers, which are more fatigue resistant, the glycogen stores or glycogen depletion that you might experience during the race, and whether you can sort of implement some strategies to maintain those stores during the race. things like heat accumulation, so thermal regulation might be a factor as well. So there are quite a few kind of factors. Your mitochondria machinery, if you want, or your mitochondria density, all of those things are likely to contribute to the coupling that, you know, someone experiences. But we don't have that data, as far as I know anyway, just yet.
Yeah, makes sense. I'm just looking through my list of questions here to see what we didn't cover.
It's just to add, I think particularly in running, muscle damage is probably going to be another factor that perhaps, you know, contributes. So basically your running economy, your running efficiency is going to be compromised during running, perhaps to a greater extent than during cycling, because you have that kind of eccentric component. So there are a few things.
Then you could even hypothesize that what shoes you choose to run in could have an effect, because they might have an impact on how much muscle damage you experience.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
What I was going to ask next was whether you think decoupling is how much it might be related to your, let's say, your critical speed or your general capacity in a fresh state, or how much it is completely independent of that. Is that something you can speculate about?
I don't know. I can't speculate. I don't know if those runners that show low decoupling do that because that's something, it's a kind of a consequence of the training that they do, and then basically that allows them to, so you do some training, this type of training, this volume of training, this intensity, then that has an effect on your decoupling, and then that affects your performance. Or whether it's kind of the other way around, whether it's your, you know, some inherited characteristics that you have, and then that allows you to do the training and then allows you to run a high percentage and maintain that high percentage of your critical speed throughout the marathon. So I think it's going to be a combination of some sort of physiological traits that you might have, but also what type of training you do, and whether you're, you know, how your training distribution and all of those things can probably affect your decoupling and the size and onset of decoupling.
Yeah, and probably there is a lot of overlap between the adaptations to training, because if somebody has a very high critical speed, then that's normally because they have been training a lot, and they are also doing long runs and things like that. That will will contribute to also better fatigue
resistance. I think the two are going to overlap quite a bit. Yeah.
Okay. And one thing that you found that was quite interesting was that when you separately analyzed females versus males, you found that the females had lower magnitude of decoupling and a later onset of decoupling. So, what do you think might be the reasons for that?
So with females, they have, as expected, a low critical speed. But what we found was that they run at a high percentage of their critical speed, and they also exhibit a low decoupling compared to male athletes. Why that is happening? Again, probably there's quite a bit of research on females having, for example, their thresholds at a higher percentage of their VO2 max. So their lactate threshold, for example, happens at a higher percentage closer to their VO2 max compared to males. So I think that's all kind of building the picture that females are more fatigue resistant than males. And why that happens, again, it's going to go back to those sort of potential factors that we think can contribute to decoupling. So muscle fibers, we know that females have a high percentage on average of type 1 muscle fibers, which are more fatigue resistant. Females have a higher volume and density of mitochondria. So all of those kind of factors that potentially determine decoupling, it seems that females have a better profile to be able to cope with or to be able to kind of prevent this declining in critical speed and basically fatigability during exercise.
Mm, yeah.
So,
And that makes sense when we look at some in ultra running, for example. You have some examples of like, when you get to 200 mile races, we have some like Courtney, what is her name? Courtney D.
Yeah, I can't remember the name, but I know that, yes, in case it's basically females outperform males.
Maybe that's too long too, because there's so much else that goes into that than just the physiology. Like psychology starts to play a massive role, but I think that's the gap does seem to close over longer distances compared to, let's say, the 1500 or 800 or 100 meters if you look at the percentages.
Yeah, absolutely. So it seems that the longer you go, that gap, which is usually about 10% for males, so males running about 10% faster than females, when you go to kind of the endurance and towards ultra endurance events, that gap seems to be closing. And as you said, there's a few examples of females. I don't think on average females are going to outperform males in ultra-endurance events. But certainly they are more, by the looks of it, but the data that we have and from lab data from other groups, they seem to be more fatigue resistant compared to males. Yeah.
Mm. Then final question on this topic, I guess, is where do you see future research going? Do you already have some follow-up studies that you're working on, or what would you want to see done in this field of research?
Yeah, so we did a follow-up study so one of the limitations of this approach, the way we calculate critical speed, is based on the best performance. So your best your fastest speed over 800 meters, 1K, 1.5K, 3K, and so on. So over a range of distances. But that doesn't mean that your best performance is your maximal performance. And if we want to calculate critical speed, we should be doing maximal effort. So that's a limitation of this approach that we are taking. So we did a study during lockdown trying to basically compare. You know, we got a group of people and we asked them to just do your normal training for 6 weeks. And then we asked them to do some intentional maximal efforts. And we saw that, I guess, as one would expect, when you ask them to do maximal efforts, the critical speed that we were able to estimate, as opposed to just data from the raw, normal, regular training data, the estimation of critical speed was higher when you asked them to do a maximal effort, which I think makes sense. I guess the thing is the difference wasn't so high. It was only about 1 kilometer per hour. So it wasn't a huge difference. So I think if you have enough data, you can make this kind of take this approach forward. But that's something that we did over lockdown. We also want to look at, that's something we are working with Barry, trying to predict from the training data we have, the decoupling that we saw in the marathon. So I think we're starting to look at things like the number of long runs, the training volume that you do, and whether all those things can help predict whether you are going to experience decoupling during your marathon. And at the moment, we are not seeing any obvious trends, but we need to look at that data a bit more closely and see if we can sort of get some insight as to what might be helpful in terms of training to try to minimize that decoupling.
Yeah. Well, that will be interesting to follow and see if you find anything, because as you say, then if you find any relation there, then that could also potentially be used in a prescriptive way for when training for these long events where it is important to minimize the decline in performance. So then moving on from decoupling to just a general question for you as a physiologist, if you could give three pieces of advice for the listeners of this podcast on how to improve their endurance performance, what would that be?
I guess based on, I'm trying to think, there was a tweet from Mike Joyner a long time ago. It was like, run a lot of miles some of them faster than your race pace. And you know, rest. So I think, you know, keep, I guess my biggest advice will be to do your basics right, and ensure you do your training and do your resting, and you follow the kind of the basic principles, and that's going to take you a long way. And don't make things overly complicated. Just do your basics right. You know, do your basic training right, and that's going to take you a long way. Then that will be my advice.
That's really excellent advice. I love that. summed it up very nicely. And then finally, let's do some rapid-fire questions. So take just one sentence to answer each of these. And the first one is, what's your favorite book or resource related to endurance sports?
So for book, I read The Sports Gym by David Epstein, which is now a few years old, to be fair. But I did as a PhD student, and I loved it. So, I think that's the one.
Yeah, that's great. And what's an important habit that you have benefited from athletically, professionally, or personally?
I think from a professional point of view, I would say just talk to people, just engage in discussions with everyone and everyone that you come across. People usually love to talk about their research. So just go and talk to people and engage with discussions and you know, don't be shy of put yourself out there, I guess.
Great. And finally, who's somebody that you look up to or that has inspired you?
I guess looking at, you know, if we are talking about, or if I am working in the field of kind of critical power, critical speed, I would say probably Andy Jones has been a reference, you know, all his work in the last 10, 15 years. And I would just say Mark Burnley as well, who is, we are doing some sort of projects together as well. So I think them two are really people that I aspire to be like, basically. Yeah.
Andy Jones is also a past guest on the podcast, so I'll try to remember to put that link as well as the one to Mark Burnley's episodes that he has done. So related listening for listeners that find this topic interesting. Finally, Danielle, do you have any online or social media presence where people can follow you, or any projects that you want to mention, or ventures you want to plug, or anything like that?
I've got a tweet. I'm not very active on Twitter, but my Twitter is Daniel_Muniz_. I'm happy to interact and chat to people. So,
Yeah, brilliant. Okay, well, thank you so much, Daniel. It was great to talk to you. Thank you for sharing your insights from your research, and you're looking forward to seeing what you come up with next in the future research projects that you have going on.
No, thank you for having me. Thank you.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com with link to Dr. Muniz's profile on ResearchGate and Twitter, as well as, of course, the paper we discussed today, which is called Decoupling of Internal and External Workload During a Marathon, Analysis of Durability in 82,303 Recreational Runners. There are some other episodes that we mentioned and papers that I will link to as well that are relevant, so check out the show notes or the episode description. Also, just a reminder, especially if you are new to the podcast, that there is a ton of content in the archives of the podcast, including both interviews. You can search by category on the website, and you can also look up the beginner tip episodes, the Q&A episodes, and so on. The best place to find this all organized is on the website, scientifictriathlon.com. So check that out, especially if you're new to the podcast and you want more content and to catch up on your favorite topics. If you want to improve your triathlon performance and want help to achieve your goals, then consider working with a scientific triathlon coach or training plan. Whether you're just getting into triathlon or you're trying to qualify for a world championship event or even want to race professionally, we have experience in all of those scenarios and would love to discuss further around if and how we can help you on your triathlon journey. Find out more and contact us on scientifictriathlon.com, and we can discuss your specific goals and needs and see what's best for you. Finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Roka, that you can find on roka.com. Check out their wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, and exceptional sunglasses and prescription glasses for everything from day-to-day wear to extreme action sports. Use the promo code that you can get on roka.com/TTS to get 20% off your entire Roka order. And thank you to Senate. Use the Senate swim trainer to improve your technique, power, stamina, and your swim training consistency. Get 20% off your order on the swim trainer with a promo code that you can get on senateswimtrainer.com/TTS. And don't forget that this is a risk-free investment. If you don't love it after 2 weeks, you can send it back and you'll get a full refund. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlons.